This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
From athletic stuff like a full court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff like a half mile stroll. Get those steps in. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
You saw the game-winning play once, but have to replay it 3 times on the way back to the hotel. Because some moments don't end at the buzzer. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
Right now, get up to 20% off select online storage solutions. Put heavy-duty HDX totes to good use, protecting what's important to you. The solid, impact-resistant design prevents cracking, and the clear base and sides make items easy to find, even when the totes are stacked. Find select online shelving and tote storage up to 20% off at the Home Depot to organize every room in your home, from your garage to your attic. Visit HomeDepot.com. How doers get more done.
Welcome to Maximize Your Hunt, the podcast dedicated to those who want the most out of their hunting property. This podcast explores land management, habitat improvement, and hunting strategies that will help you maximize your time in the field. Follow along as industry professionals that live and breathe whitetail deer share their secrets to success. And now, the founder of Whitetail Landscapes, your host, John Teeter.
Hi, I'm John Teeter, Whitetail Landscapes. This is Maximize Your Hunt. Welcome back, everyone. I'm feeling a little under the weather today, but I am home and relaxing. I do not have to do anything. I did get a chance to cut some timber yesterday. That was fun. And, I'm excited. I'm excited because I've got a lot of good consulting clients coming up here over the next, month or two. And, my favorite time to consult is in August and September. I find it funny that a lot of folks that do this either professionally, as a hobby, what have you, they enjoy these winter months as a period of consulting. I do not. And I'll tell you why, and I think it's a big miss on a lot of people's part. I have a much better perception of landscape layout based on the vegetation quality and quantity on the landscape period. It's a big misnomer with a lot of people where, yeah, I can see the property. I can see it for what it is. I know what a depleted property looks like. I also have a chance to see the vegetation quality and quantity, and that's the most important criteria for looking at a property. And I think one of the things that we lack sometimes is dimension. And I'm going to talk about dimension today in the podcast that we're going to have a new guest on. And it's important to look at the property in layers and levels. And it gives you that opportunity to look at the vegetation quality. And that's something that we're going to talk about. And in fact, that's going to be a conversation that I'm going to have on my habitat day this summer. We're going to explain to clients or non-clients, it's going to be a mixed mash of folks that are attending my habitat day, some specifics around vegetation quality. And I think that's really important to consider when you're looking at your landscape. And there's a bunch of easy ways to do that. And that'll be for a different podcast, but I figured I'd just throw that out there. I hear people say, well, you know, you can't get to me till August or September. And I'm like, geez, those are the best months to consult. You're a lucky client that you hit that window. And that's something that I just want to throw out because I had a conversation yesterday with a client that I have for next year, 2025. So, okay, enough with that. Let me get my new guests on. Matt, are you on the line?
Yeah, I am. Thanks for having me, John.
All right. So, Matt Williams, you and I have got to be friends over the past, I don't know, it hasn't been a year, but we were introduced together. Jim Ward, we have a common friend, and he introduced us. And I've really enjoyed conversing with you. I think you're extremely interesting, and there's a lot of dimension to you, sir. And so I think today's conversation is going to be kind of neat. I want you to kind of introduce your business, its role in this wildlife world, and where you see yourself going. And I want to kind of get into the details after that.
Well, my name is Matt Williams, and my business is I have a small mushroom farm and foraging operation that I'm handing over to my children. And my primary business, more increasingly, is this, what we call a mycohabitat, which has two meanings. Myco is Latin for mushroom, and the habitat's the obvious one. But if we break that apart separately, it's my cohabitat. So there's some dimension in the name to give you an idea of what we do. And what I specifically do is I'm a fungal consultant, but also develop innovative solutions for property owners with fungi. And then one further, I have a background in organic farming and market farming. And I have a lot of crossover into the food plot world, and fungi play an enormous part of our soil. And so I bring that to the table as well.
So let's start to go down the road, and it's important to talk about, I think, misses. And a lot of times, it's important for me to recognize what I miss on the landscape, and I've missed this topic. Mushroom and lichen and things that we don't pay a whole lot of attention to, because if you look at some of these charts, they look at the volume of consumption and the interest for deer specifically. And it's not really high in the totem pole, at least in the charts that we see either from quality deer management previously or NDA. But I actually think that's a big misnomer. And I think in my area specifically, I've been paying more attention to the woody material and the related fungal material that deer have interest in. It wasn't because of you per se necessarily. It's me starting to think a little bit differently about my landscape. But then when you came into the equation, you're like, hey, whoa, you can do this. You can put this on your property. You got a North Slope property. You got areas where it needs some work. This is a good way to make some improvements in those areas that are less productive. And I'm like, whoa, this is a light bulb moment for me. I've got these north-facing slopes that I predominantly focus on woody material, but I could have a fruit, a fungal fruit is what I call it. And I could have a fruiting body be of interest to deer very seasonally, but for a duration of the season, and that would fill a gap. And that's an important gap because the woody material that they consume decreases a little bit, not totally to nil, in those summer and fall periods, early fall periods, excuse me. So I'd like to talk a little bit about what products you sell and how do you apply those on the landscape. So maybe we can go to the history of what are mushrooms used for traditionally and where we're at today and how we utilize them for wildlife purposes.
Well, fungi is a kingdom, or larger than the kingdom Animalia or the kingdom Plantasia. So we're talking about the largest kingdom of organisms on the planet Earth, and they all have very different roles. There's a lot of specialists, and there's a few generalists in there as well. So what I concentrate specifically on are mushrooms that are edible to humans and wildlife. That's where my crossover specifically lies. Now, it's not like they're just eating mushrooms, as you alluded to. First of all, deer don't just eat anything. If they eat something, it has nutritive value to it, and they're seeking it at a specific time of the year for a reason. Secondly, they eat a lot of mushrooms, and they're on the increase during hunting season and going into the early winter. And then as we cross over to the snow load months, for those of us here in the north, they're all over mosses and lichens and other members of the fungi kingdom as well. So it's not an anomalistic food. It's probably best described as the forgotten food. And what we offer is not just mushrooms that come and go seasonally. there's pretty good chance, especially for us up in the north, that they're around pretty much the entire year from the time it thaws out till the time it freezes up again. And as we move further south, they're going to be more spring and autumn and early winter specific. And as we get into the deep south, they're going to be more autumn and winter specific. But this mushroom in particular is native to North America, and we sell it as a solution for you to create a mushroom food plot. Which is, if you're not familiar with mushroom food plotting, fungi have crop needs, and those crop needs include, shade and moisture, and their enemies, or the fungi's enemies, are going to be the sun and the wind. So more or less, we can plop this down any shady spot, which means we don't have to open up the canopy, which is huge for food resources, because, you know, that's the number one complain about food plots is not only do I have to keep the canopy open all the time with my cutting, but I have to have it open. So for whatever reason, if you wanted to provide food, you know, in your travel corridors or closer back to bedding or on a north facing wooded hill slope, like you and I are doing, it makes a lot of sense to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. This is interesting. So let's get into the specifics, right? So you're not utilizing stumps and inoculating stumps. I mean, that is one option, correct?
Yeah, that's something I'm working towards right now. Jim Ward asked me to create a solution to rot stumps fast. Basically, they're expensive to remove, you know, $150 a whack or whatever. And they take a long time to rot. So he and I got together on this, and he kind of tasked me with figuring out that. And I'm kind of doing that in a trial and error way right now and working towards that. It takes a long time to take a mushroom from a wild captured specimen to a productive spawn that's clean and can be replicated. And that's a laboratory thing, which is another part of what we do, obviously. And there are other mushrooms that I have on the horizon that fit kind of a dual purpose. They rot faster, but it's more of a targeted approach where we're providing food specifically to hunting season or end of the winter for those of us in the deep winter. There's some mushrooms that form in autumn, but they remain viable as a food resource all the way through the frozen winter. And as you get the melt freeze patterns, those become softer and pliable, and they begin to consume them again deep winter.
So I think it's important to talk a little bit about the substrate that I've used specifically. So, you know, I was able to get some mulch from a local arborist company type company. I have buddies that are in that business. Obviously, I cut a lot of timber myself. So, you know, I had that as a resource. And then I went down to my buddy farmer down the road, and he had, you know, straw all over the place, and, you know, he gave it to me for about nothing. And I created kind of the substrate that you had suggested. Okay, put this in this location and add the spawn, etc. I want to dialogue a little bit about that. So let's just kind of talk about setting up these environments, size, dimension, etc. What are the additives, and what's the best way to go about doing this? And look, give some specifics on locations, and even, you know, maybe there's woodland associates that we might want to consider. Like, for example, are coniferous trees a better option because of, you know, their shade, you know, their shade support, or better off under an oak species, etc. So maybe you can dialogue a little bit about that, and maybe some of the networking, you know, the type of networking that happens, you know, through this, through these fungal networks that are their relationships there as well.
Right. So what we're doing when we create this is basically more or less taking the equivalent of a whole tree and mulching it up, right, and confining it to a region instead of one small area where that tree trunk would sit and take forever. And we'll talk about that rotting process in a moment. But basically what we're doing is we're soaking a bale of straw or raking the ground clean and throwing a bale of straw on the ground to get rained upon heavily for a few days or whatever. And then we're spawning it, and there's directions. We have the video, John, you know how to do this, but basically we're creating a lasagna of lignins and cellulose. Now, straw is a soft, pliable lignin and cellulose, so the mushrooms colonize it very rapidly and get a jump start. And then it kind of becomes like a moisture retention core too. And then we cover the whole thing in sawdust or wood chips or corn stover or more straw or, you know, any basically brown compost item, which for me is sawdust and straw, because like you said, I go and sweep the farmer's semi trailers that haul the straw, and I get it all for free, and I get broken bales for dirt cheap. And then the sawdust, there's more sawmills up here than there are churches and bars, which is saying something in the UP. So long story short, I'm basically turning free materials into deer food. And the way that that happens is the mushroom colonizes it. It looks like spider webs, you know, or even like mold. Mold is a fungi, obviously. And so it colonizes it. And after it fully colonizes it, this one's a very rapid colonization mushroom. Some are very slow, but this one's fast. After, let's say, 90 days-ish, it could be longer. It could be a month longer. It could be a month shorter, too. And if we use more spawn than the standard issue recipe, which we talk about in our instructions, too, you can even shave a month or two off of it more. Long story short, we're turning those lignified cellulosic dead wood into to deer food by allowing those mushrooms to colonize it. And they're going to fruit over and over and over throughout the year when it rains. And they hold so much moisture that when you make a massive one, that it pretty much goes nonstop. There's always going to be a few mushrooms popping up. And then, of course, through that breakdown of all that material of rot occurring, which is bacteria and fungi working in symbiosis, they're going to bolster the native fungi and the soil that's already present there. So everyone's big on inoculants right now, right? Introducing stuff. Well, first of all, where did it come from? Are we bringing in a new invasive species from another continent? We're so quick to charge in and try to rescue everything. There's there in that grant, let's say we take a tablespoon of soil, right? There may be 50,000 different fungi varieties in that tablespoon, but only 10 of those mycorrhizal fungi may lend themselves to cultivation. So what we're doing is we're just gleaming the easiest ones that allow themselves to be cultivated and saying, ah, the heck with the rest, right? And so that's biodiversity is the driver of all our ecosystems. So what we want to do is bolster what's already there or repair it. And by placing this down, like any rotten wood, which drives our landscape and our soil's food web, as well as the web of life itself, it's bolstering that, and it's going to uplift it, and it's going to increase the diversity. And as the deer and the other animals come through, they deposit scat there. Well, that scat's full of all kinds of different bacteria and fungi, which some of which depend on the enzymes of digestion to be viable. And so over time, as they deposit their scat there, we throw woody debris on top of it, or leaves fall and other organic matter like thatch comes down. It basically provides a perfect germination vessel to increase our biological diversity even more. So more or less what we're doing is we're starting a hot spot of biological activity with this, and it trickles up to our game species.
So very good description that you have there, and obviously good detailing the specifics. Let's go to locations, and let's think about the size and shape of these areas specifically. And then I want to go after that. I want to talk about the nutritional benefits, you know, specifically what we see, because, you know, I follow this one individual, and he has mushrooms in his diet on a daily basis. And it really seems like, you know, his interest is specifically health, human health. And so there's some lap over, at least as it relates to animals and the nutritional benefit. But let's talk about layout. And, you know, this is all in the mind of the designer. So if you're going to do a layout on a property and you're utilizing kind of this kind of sawdusty, you know, mulchy, strawy type area, you know, there's certain size and dimensions as well as interests. And so how have you kind of laid those out in your particular property? And you're scaling this, so you'd have a whole property in mushrooms, I'm sure. But let's talk a little bit about that.
Well, I don't want to go with the whole property with mushrooms. I want to put my best foods in my best spots, right? Just like anything else, you kind of cluster all that really good, diverse food, the best of the best, in those sweetest spots that give you the best shot, because that's why we're all in this in the end, is put venison in the freezer and maybe something to look back on the wall, right? Where I like to place them, it all depends on the property. I've seen a lot of different properties now and talked to a lot of different landowners for placement. Guys like you are using them in travel corridors. I like to put them near any funnel or pinch to cause them to slow down and stop. And also, anytime you put a mushroom food plot or a lot of really rich fungal resources in the landscape, it seems like the browse lines are heavier on that anyway. And so using it to help direct movement is a very wise strategy, for whatever it's worth. Now, it can also be used as kind of a bit of a water resource too, because fungi are a little bit more so than plants. It's about the same amount. Plants, let's say, are 60% water. Fungi are like 70. But the kicker is that fungi thermoregulate. So on a hot day, it's a cold drink of water. And on a cold day, it's a cool drink of water, right? Or sorry, a warmer drink of water, so to speak. So there is kind of that aspect to it as well. And then it's the landscape itself. Where does the water pool, you know, is the permaculturists call them swales. A swale is just something that's organic material that absorbs water. And if you have a hillside and a log falls across that hillside, well, where does all that material wash up against that log? Well, in that spot, the water is pooling there. It's calming down, right? Rivers do this. It's called drop pool. It's the basis of river geomorphology, right? Water always tries to self-level. So if I see a spot, let's say that I have a water hole, and then there's a little drainage that fills that water hole, and the water after it fills that water flow kind of forms a little pond in an area right there around it, or maybe a little bit downstream. Well, I know that's a good pond, you know, good spot to put it, because there's a lot of water going there anyway. And this is a giant sponge, so it's going to soak up the water and retain it.
So just on that, Matt, one question. So, you know, you're getting these questions probably come up. Well, is in these hydric soils, is there too much saturation? Can there be too much saturation?
No.
Okay. And I think that's...
No, it's going to go to field capacity, and that's it. To soak mushroom logs as a mushroom farmer, they go dry for a week or two. Well, I mean, it takes time for it to eat enough lignin to do it again, 6 to 8 weeks for most of them. But basically, I run them dry for a few weeks, and then I plunge them underneath water to mimic a flood or a cold, long rain. Literally submerging them. So if they're not submerged in stale anaerobic water for more than a day or two, they're totally fine. If it's water that has good aeration and it's in a floodplain, as long as it's not like whitewater rapids, you know, erosion through there, it's probably going to be there whenever it's over, and it's probably going to benefit from it as long as it doesn't happen extremely frequently.
So I did, and that great information, I did, I don't know how many yards, maybe 5 to 8 yards. Basically, my layout is it's on a north slope. It's on a benchy location where I actually have, you know, little swales and kind of water tributaries coming down to feed kind of the moisture that we just talked about, right? So I'm thinking about those kind of microclimates that I'm kind of doing and laying out. But your products specifically, you have small application options and then you have larger application options. Can you kind of explain the difference? Are they different mushrooms or the same type of mushroom, just as a different spawn or, excuse me, quantity of spawn, et cetera? Can you dialogue a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'm just offering this one mushroom to get everyone started on the right page. It gets really confusing if we start adding more in right now, and it's hard enough to communicate this as it is. And this mushroom is more prolific than any other, so it's not like, you know, we're really losing anything. There are other mushrooms in the works that are native to North America, just like this one. This one in particular is called Strepharia or wine cap, and it's fairly commonly cultivated around the world to the tune of hundreds of thousands of hectares. So it's not like it's, a small outlying crop. It's actually one of the top mushrooms produced in the world.
Can you go through the fruiting cycle real quick with that particular mushroom variety that you just mentioned?
Sure. So Strepharia's fruiting parameters are very wide in comparison to many mushrooms. So this is shade parameters. We're going to, or ambient temperature. So what you do is you add the daytime high and the nighttime low and subtract it, and you get an ambient temperature, a mean or an average. Long story short, we're looking for somewhere north of 40 degrees, 35 degrees to about 80, 85 degrees on the top end, and more towards that 75, 80 degree mark. But if there's a good breeze through there and it's in like a nice pine area where it gets thermal protection, it could even be hotter outside and it'll probably still fruit.
Okay. So if I was to establish, and it takes anywhere between, we'll just say 60 to 90 days to get some fruiting opportunity. Yes. What's the ideal start point? And then do I have to feed it? Do I have to add more stuff to it?
Let's say it takes 60 to 120 days. Sometimes it can go a little long. It just depends on your saturation rate, your spawn rate, how much, they're variables. But let's say You don't have to add anything new to it once you get it going. It's a sit and forget scenario. It's going to stay good for 3 to 5 years, keep producing mushrooms. Around year three, they'll begin to dwindle off. They'll be the strongest in the first year or two. And then up to 5 years, you'll still see mushrooms. But what's going to be left is beautiful black compost at that point. If you choose to, every other year, I would add new mushrooms, or every year. Like I talked about earlier, the deer deposit their scat, and the other animals do too. And so there are seeds in there, and of course all those fungi and bacteria. So by adding a new layer, that allows some of that stuff to get a foothold. And now we've got diversity in the mix. We're probably not going to see as many of this targeted species, the Stropharia that we put in there, but what we are going to see is we're going to see other saprophytic mushrooms, which are native to that landscape, begin to appear in there. And that's good. That offers diversity. And diversity also gives us a prolonged period. It'll generally be more attractive later in the season with regards to fungi. They're still gonna check it. You know, if you feed a stray dog three times, it's never gonna walk by your door without looking for a meal. Same thing with deer. If they find a spot that's, you know, got one of their favorite foods, which the old timers in habitat management called mushrooms vegetable meat, to give you an idea of how nutritive they are to deer. They're not going to walk by without looking for a meal. Matter of fact, they're not even going to cruise through that valley or shelf without scent checking that spot for mushrooms.
So I can tell you in my scenario, I used it to create interest along a travel corridor. That would be my typical use, but we can talk about other applications in that scenario. You know, I have a little vernal pool adjacent to that, where there's a water collection point. And it just becomes a stopping ground, basically. These deer, from my videos, they basically all went over and were interested. They were digging their face into the straw, you know, looking for food. Very interesting kind of, you know, scenario. And it was new to me, right? This is kind of a new thing for me. And mm-hmm. I found their interest levels to be as significant. Now, it was a great travel corridor, you know, that I laid out. But adding this... Sure. You know, adjacent to a hunting location, which my stand's right there, seemed to be a kind of a good additive feature. So the next question I kind of have for you is, you're going down this road of adding to the landscape and thinking about scale. You know, it's tough because it's a small location that I have kind of laid out, but I want to expand it. I want to make it bigger. What are some things that I could potentially do? Can I dig up the mycelium in the ground, and can I add spores to other locations and create strips and rows? How have you seen this, like, as from an application sense across the landscape, either with, you know, your clients or you specifically, that are kind of interesting and intriguing to you?
So the essence of a mushroom farmer is, how do I do more with pretty much nothing, right? And so we can totally expand this, but the yields aren't going to be quite as high as when we start from spawn. And so there is that to consider. You know, the average yields from if you make it exactly the way I send it in the instructions and tell you to, you're going to be anywhere from 1 to 3+ pounds a year. If you added irrigation or had a good water year, it could be as high as 10 pounds a square foot a year. Right. And we're not just talking about the square footage of coverage. Our smallest, you know, pack is 50 square, but realistically it puts off mushrooms several feet in every direction around it. So we're talking about 100 and something square, you know, of coverage for whatever it's worth. Beyond that, you know, and scale, like you said, you know, scaling up's always a pain in the butt for a small business. John, can you re-ask the question? I got off of my tangent and forgot what I was supposed to answer.
I was going down a road. I was just talking about having decomposing material basically across the landscape. Perfect. And expanding that concept a little bit. And then, you know, what can we do with our existing mushroom plots to kind of extend them, so to speak? And that would be kind of the approach that I would take if I was looking at this a little more in scale. And we're going from a small footprint area, you know, maybe a 5-yard area to, you know, 20 or 30. Yeah, a plot maybe. Yeah.
Perfect. Yeah, so we can do that. What we'd do is we'd just grab that colonized material and it'd pretty much be glued together. If you've seen it by now, you know, even with the deer, you know, pawing at it and tearing it up, there'll be big chunks. Or you grab a pitchfork and just grab a whole bunch of it. Throw it in buckets of wheelbarrows, and then use it as spawn. Basically use the exact same directions for the best results and go through the same process with the material, right? Or you can, you know, skip the straw now that you've got it colonized on wood chips and just mix it heavier into those wood chips. I always recommend starting a new one depending on the size of it. I mean, if you're going crazy like I am, I'm fixing to do big plots, you know, half acre or more. with this. And I'm going to have to just jump started. I'm going to have the sawdust, which I get for free, dump trucked in, which is like $150 a dump truck load for a short run. But I mean, it, you know, it hauls what, 8 yards at a time or more. So anyway, long story short, I'm just going to jump start it and then also work forestry mulching whenever I do my log job into this, and try to minimize the amount trucked in. But you can certainly grab those other plots and do them. Now, if you have a plot and you're stealing some from it, know that that disturbance from that plot is going to stunt the one that was already growing, right? So if you want one that you want to make way bigger next year and another one that you still want to hunt on, you know, this year, next year, whatever, and you don't want to bother it, might want to make two.
I think it's a great idea. And one application that I just worked on recently, and it's funny, you know, I've got my Legend and I'm starting to work into that Legend, you know, new concepts and ideas and specific plants. And in this case, adding kind of a mushroom travel corridor and an interior of a food plot. And it's just that, you know, the sneak trail on the interior side, it gave a good opportunity to be kind of a focal point and have a social zone adjacent to that. But it gave me kind of this concept of saying, what are the additives? If I want to add shrubbery or I want to add a fruiting tree or something along those lines, what are the additives or what are my options? And this to me is just a compounding option that I think is extremely valuable. I want to bring up another kind of failure point, Matt, and something that I had to talk to you about a little bit. Conifers are all over the landscape. So in this kind of preferential, we'll say mulching material, conifers typically aren't utilized. And can you explain why that might be a problem for some people, or at least in this application, why, you know, it takes a while to break down, et cetera, in this mulch mix that you know, we're kind of establishing in these key locations?
Yeah, it's all right to have a little bit in there. If we can keep it under 10% or right at 10%, we're doing great. You know, one out of every 10 trees that you chip up or whatever, pine or cedar or others. But when we get beyond that, it gets tough because there are phenols and terpenes, and those are basically what you smell is like pine that we associate with it. And those are rot resistant trees, basically. That's why we built with them. You know, that's is the fungi and bacteria do not colonize them exceptionally well. There are always, you know, outliers. There's one fungi I'm working with that likes to eat treated wood. It's so aggressive. But anyway, long story short, so those don't rot very well. And what we're doing is actually encouraging rot to bolster the whole soil food web. So we're kind of shooting ourselves in the foot by putting out stuff that they're not able to decompose. And this is a very rapid decomposition mushroom that we're employing. And those materials are very slow to decompose.
Yeah, that's a good point and something that we had talked about when I first got into this, because I was looking for material and you're like, chop them all up, chop every tree, you know, and then we said, wait, not conifers, at least at the quantity, you know, I had originally anticipated, because, you know, a lot of us have trees lying all over the place and you just want to grab something. But it's important to have more live material, you know, than chopping up or mulching kind of dead material in this equation, or does it really make a difference?
Doesn't really make a difference. The bad part about chopping, you know, ultra live material, like the leaves in particular, is that's a compost green. When you mix greens and browns, you get heat. Thermophilic compost occurs. So, I mean, it depends on the depth. If you have a green and brown mix, but it's only a foot deep or less spread out on the ground, it's not going to do much with thermophilic action. But if it's 3 feet, you know, by 3 feet, it's going to heat up. And that could go kind of to your benefit. You get some thermophilia in there, and basically then when you expose that to, you know, spread it out or whatever, the mycelium can jump on it. So it's not like it's a terrible thing, but what you don't want is to have a steaming pile that you're trying to grow mushrooms on, because that's not going to work. It's too hot.
Good point. All right, so let's go to the nutrient side of things, and I want you to go down the human health piece of this quickly. One little anecdotal thing. It's been very interesting to me to even have this dialogue with you, primarily because if you think about everything we focus on is cutting timber and doing our property layout and food plots and the whole nine, this very rarely comes in the equation. But mushrooms on the landscape, they have medicinal purposes, and food is medicine is a concept that we hear all the time. And it's amazing to me that, you know, and again, it doesn't fall in the animal or plant kingdom. What kingdom is this? It's in its own world, basically.
Well, plants and animals evolved out of fungi. That's why we have similar immune systems. That's why fungi work for us.
So it just, it's amazing that something like this, a decomposer like this, can take carbon and turn it into protein. And I've always found that amazing. And it's amazing that, you know, that we can have this across our landscapes. And most of us aren't aware of what varieties or types, but the deer are showing us what they prefer and utilize. And so what I want to talk about is a little bit of, what do deer eat naturally? And then what are the nutritional benefits that you're seeing either from a human health side or an animal side?
Well, there's nutritional and then there's pharmacological benefits, penicillin, yeast. Basically, most of our pharmaceuticals are either derived directly from fungi or from plants that have a really strong fungal connection, right? And we, as animals who evolved out of fungi much later than plants, are able to process these same immuno benefits. Viruses and bacteria have been trying to kill plants and fungi since, you know, fungi inherited the earth or whatever. So fungi tie into everything we do. There's trees can't absorb water from the soil. They can't pull any nutrients out of the soil. Their fungal partners do all of that, right? Even within the trunk of the tree, there's a three-dimensional spider web that runs the entire tip to tip of the tree itself, from the root to the very last leaf, right? And that's made of fungi within these, and the plant cells are around them as a vestibule, so to speak. So fungi are pervasive. They work in everything we do. And fungi drive our ecosystems. The whole soil food web begins and ends with fungi. Fungi and bacteria working together is rot in particular, but fungi are the infrastructure of that ordeal. The bacteria can't move anything anywhere. They can only sit there and, you know, exude, so to speak. The fungi do everything else, right? And those fungi and those bacteria in that soil or on that piece of wood on the ground or our mushroom food plot attract things that eat fungi. Everything that's ever survived an extinction event on our planet has been aligned with fungi. That's how it happened. We all know about the shrew and it is surviving when the dinosaurs died. All placental mammals that have evolved out of that shrew are also aligned with fungi because guess what? That shrew was aligned with chitin, which is as a feed resource, which is, you know, what insects are made out of and also what fungi are made out of, right? So when we look at this, I mean, it works into everything we touch, everything we do, everything we want to do, everything that's working for us and against us. It's there. It's just we're glossing over it, just like we are as a wildlife feed resource. It's just something that we saw and we were like, yep, mushrooms, keep her moving. You know, but really, that's where the conversation begins and ends with life. Whenever you and I die and our bodies go to the earth, the fungi are going to consume us and transport us, right? And then whenever whatever eats us, you know, or consumes us, dies, the same cycle is going to be repeated. And it's repeated at every scale in between. So we have those fungal mycelial threads growing throughout our tubes, really, growing throughout the landscape in the soil. Well, what feeds upon those? You know, the arthropods, the nematodes, and everything else. That's where it all begins. And then it keeps escalating in scale all the way up to our game species. You know, there's prey that are attracted to a feed resource. Predators are attracted to prey. Some of those predators become prey for larger prey. And it keeps hopscotching up to ourselves, right? Fungi are the basis of the food web. It'd be completely plausible to say that they are the web of life themselves.
Matt, well said. Let's talk a little bit medicinal, and you kind of went there a little bit for yourself. I know that you've done some prescriptive recommendations, and I'm going with the human health here side of things. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, what the importance of ingesting mushrooms just from a health side, and maybe there's a benefit to animals, right? So we can go there.
Right. The very best way to get mushrooms into your body for pharmacological benefits is to consume them in your diet. We as primates, if you want to classify us under taxonomy, consume the least amount of fungi out of the greater primates. And so that should tell us that we need to up that. So mushrooms like shiitake, portobello cremini, you know, agaricus, they're, when cooked, especially, all wonderful mushrooms. They all have great health benefits. The more exotic mushrooms and the wild mushrooms tend to have more benefits because they're grown outdoors in contact with the environment. And what you know it, if you grow something indoors, it's not as nutritive as the stuff grown outdoors, right? And so those wild mushrooms, or those wild imitated mushrooms, which is what I specialize in with our farm, are much more medicinal in nature, and you feel it. You just have a pep in your step. It's there are pharmacological agents that are, you know, especially in the case of Stropharia, that are novel agents that are not seen in any other mushrooms. So when we're talking about hundreds of different mushrooms throughout the year, that's a whole lot of medicine going in as food for our herd or our turkeys. Turkeys are really big on mushrooms, bears, quail. I mean, you name it, pretty much any species is going to be involved in it. So it does support their immune systems, and it does bolster their immune systems. There's repeated studies that show mycophagists, which are animals that consume fungi, gain weight faster, and they tend to build fat reserves faster as well, which means that they're maximizing their other feed resource by intaking the chitin or the chitin. It uplifts the rest of the diet, especially in ruminants. That's why we use chitin in cattle feed, is to get increased lactation from heifers and to build more body weight for steers, right? It's widely used, and that's generally cheap crustacean-based chitin, or if you're fancy, you have money for the insect-based chitin, and it's often plugged in as a soy alternative in organic feeds. So what we're doing is mushrooms are water-soluble chitin, which is even better for a ruminant, especially deer, which aren't super ruminants. They're not made to eat highly lignified foods. When you look at the design of their stomach, and then especially, you know, as a long-tract stomach, which most mammalian mycophagists display a long tract with a spiral colon, deer literally programmed to the T as far as their stomach design is concerned to eat fungi wherever possible. And there are some studies which have alluded to it being as much as 70%+. And more generally, the NDA pegs at about 10 to 15% increasing to maybe 20 during hunting season. So that's why we're involved in all the, you know, folks like you and the Prove It Tour. And then, of course, MSU's Deer Lab and Dr. Deer, getting it in front of them was because there's just this huge discrepancy and no one really knows what to do about all this. And it deserves a second look.
Yeah, absolutely. Big mess, right? And a good description. I think that will give people some context of, you know, why there is an interest there in the physiology of the design of the animal. And its ability.
While we're talking about the physiology, you're privileged to know about the UV aspect, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's something, I mean, in itself that's worthy of attention. Deer don't have a UV filter. They see UV. So do turkeys. That's why turkey colors appear so bright. They flash. Well, guess what? Deer, their white tails, they're not white. They're pearlescent. They're kind of like crystals too, just like those turkey feathers are, right? They scatter UV. Now, the mushrooms, a lot of them, glow in the dark, basically, when UV is exposed to them, but we can't see it. Deer see blue and yellow, and almost every fungi glows blue, yellow, or green. And so do all the lichens around you. It's when you turn off the lights in the woods and expose a UV light, it looks like neon light show or Vegas in places, right? Well, it gets even better because now we know from what we discovered this year that bucks on their foreheads and on their around their eyes exude a UV reflective fluid that they use as not only a chemical smell marker but a chemical visual marker.
Yeah, that's a eureka moment. Very, very interesting science-based, obviously being studied now, information. And hold on that, Matt. Let's hold on that. Let's go down. Extremely interesting, by the way, and I think I've been starting to relay this to clients, et cetera, when I'm on site. I want you to go down the soil piece of this, and you know, once we develop this, we'll say mushroom plot, and we have soil available to us at some point in time. You know, Jim and I, and you specifically, had talked about the benefits, and you know, I'm into these elixirs, and you know, I'm a mixologist essentially.
Sure.
And I'm coming up with, you know, compost teas, and you know, right now I'm doing the same thing. You and I are doing the exact same thing, right? I'm building these big huge mounds of mulch, and I'm planning a few activities out, and I'm basically trying to inoculate and prepare portions of my ground. Today, after I get off this call, I got to go pick up, you know, 2 tons of sea salt, right? That's my next thing. And so I've got all these experiments and activities going on, and, you know, when it looks like you're done with your mushroom plot and things have kind of decomposed down, you know, the brown materials basically to nothing, you've got this very rich soil. And What do you think would be the best application of that next? Some people say automatically fruit trees, sprinkle it on your soil, start over again. What are you planning on doing with that? Are you just leaving it? Because obviously you add more feed, guess what? Something else is going to develop there. So what is your approach?
Well, it's going to get dispersed through the landscape over time. I'm just going to let nature do the shuttling around. I don't want to spend any diesel or back pain on it. And if I want a heavier dose of compost somewhere, I'll make it. Because if I make a live mycelium, you know, mushroom food plot around an apple tree, that apple tree is going to develop a better root system. It's going to grow faster. And it's going to produce fruit faster than it would if you didn't. And that's been proven. It not only elevates the browse quality, but also the growth parameters, up to a third faster growth. And so that's big. If you can stick an apple tree in the ground and skip one of those eat years, you know, where it creeps, leaps, and sleeps and all that, if you skip one of those, that's a big deal. Beyond that, I like to grow right in it. You can overcrop this. You can go with clover right off the bat. A lot of people think when you put wood on the ground that it causes nitrogen drawdown, and that's not the case unless you mix it in. If it's just sitting on top of the ground, it has very minimal nitrogen drawdown and actually usually frees up available phosphorus from the soil around it too. So anytime we have rotting wood in the landscape, there's usually a good chance that adjacent to that browse or whatever natural plants are there or we plant there are going to have elevated browse quality. And that's why if you start poking your head around and you see a lot of mushroom-rich areas, you'll notice that the browse lines kind of are really, really much better or easier to see in those mushroom-rich areas for whatever that's worth. Kind of stop right there, Fred, now, eh?
No, it's all good. It's interesting.
It's such a complex thing, and it's so simple at the same time. All right.
Wait, I got something interesting for you. So
let's talk about – all right, go ahead.
I was reading – I'm reading a book right now on water cycles, okay? And So in the 70s, in the late 70s, they were doing analysis, and they were trying to determine out – you know, why are we having these, you know, intense changes in flooding? And they're just looking at the water cycle specifically. And this, again, this was discovered in the 70s. Somebody was studying some fungal issue related to wheat crops specifically. And what they realized, and this is, again, if we call this condensation nuclei, when you're developing, you know, your perception on water cycles, one thing you got to remember is, you know, condensation is formed based on this concept of condensation nuclei. And one of the primary factors in establishing rain are fungal spores, interesting mm-hmm. enough. And they're rocket launched up into the air, and they have basically sugar content around them. There's a more sophisticated name for it, but essentially it creates a good bonding site. And so this helps increase water cycles to more stable loads. And our depletion or the desertification of some of these areas has created these up and down cycles. The Midwest states are really killing us. And one of the issues, again, is naturalized ecosystems. And so I thought that was really interesting that fungal spores played a big part in the water cycle and kind of an overlooked part. But again, they knew this in the 70s, the late 70s, this is a factor. So I don't know, just a weird tidbit. I read about that a couple of months ago.
There's a children's book called Mushroom Rain, and I read it to every one of my kids' preschool classes. And guess what it's about?
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So fungal spores, hydroscopic bonding, and then rain. Wow. It's interesting. I mean, they're just it's a network community. And learning about the water cycles is really important for kind of landscape processes.
You want to go one further. Fungi create the water lens in our soil when they decompose. They basically create those soft, loose, airy spots in the soil, right? And they translocate water into those places and fill them. And over time, as it stacks up over hundreds of years, you get water saturation and loose, airy soil all the way down. You know, what's the enemy of that, though, of course, is compaction, you know, and drainage if you suck the water out of the ground.
Yeah, and one thing you brought up earlier is the ecto and endo mycorrhizal fungi and the importance of just the interrelationships there with just water exchange and totality. I think that's a huge piece of it. And obviously the destruction qualities that we've seen kind of across the landscape, destroying the tilth and texture of our soil, which is certainly a problem. And something that I focus in a lot when I'm kind of the next level looking at these properties and layout. All right, let's go.
Hold on. With soil building, Yeah. Can we talk about that for a minute?
Let's do that.
Yeah. All right. So how long does it take a forest to create an inch of topsoil? How long does it take the best regenerative ag practices, right? We're talking 50 to 100 years is a ballpark for both of those, you know, depending, right? Well, yep. With soil building with fungi, it happens much faster. You can see this as you walk through the landscape. You see especially softer woods rapidly decompose. When we make a mushroom food plot, in 3 to 5 years, we're going to have a beautiful black soil that's remaining. We're going to have about 2 to 3 inches of it, right? And that's because this particular mushroom has a very high biological efficiency, and it's very virile and strong and wants to do the work. So another name for this mushroom is the compost mushroom, because that's what it does. It eats brown materials and leaves behind beautiful compost. And then at the end, it just kind of disappears and does its own thing, right? And goes away, and what you're left with is the most beautiful soil you've ever seen. But it doesn't just leave a big pile of compost on top. What it did is it strengthened and bolstered all the mycelium and made it efficient, all right, like an improved efficiency of the soil economy below it. And just like any gold rush, right, the people selling the shovels and the assays and everything else are going to prosper. Well, that's what that soil down below is. That transportation network is going to prosper, right? And in addition to that, the bacterial communities are going to be much more diverse and much higher bolstered, right? And so are the surrounding plants. They're going to have better mycorrhizal networks and more bacterial-rich resources. So, and all we did was throw wood chips and some straw on the ground and a little bit of mushroom and walk away. You know, I don't know how you can make it any easier than that to build soil for folks. I see people, you know, using inoculants and all these other things. You know how much fertilizers in wood chips? That's what trees are. They're giant potash factories as a minimum, you know?
Yeah, I can't get enough wood chips. I mean, I think we should wood chip our landscapes as much as possible. That's why I'm trying to do what I'm doing at this point. Hey, I got a question for you. So in these layouts, you know, just to make the connection, you know, particularly around fruit trees or other species, and let me bring this up as a concern. You know, this whole internet working, the avatar, the things that we can't see below the ground and the interrelationships there, and just the factors we just kind of laid out, you know, doing some layouts where you have these kind of, let's just say, movement and flow patterns, and I don't want to describe to people how to do your food plot layouts because it's very, you know, location specific, et cetera. But you're lining some of these food plot areas or creating focal points within food plots with the mushrooms. I mean, that's absolutely one of the strategies.
Yeah, why would I? All right, so I alluded earlier how it produces mushrooms for several feet on the edges. So you don't need to cover a whole acre to get a whole acre's coverage. Does that make sense? And then they can, you know, they'll connect to each other. They'll translocate anything that the other needs. And then likewise to the soil around them where I'm growing the plots. And then I'm growing things right on top of them to increase the, you know, the browse quality and the health and the vigor of the plants, obviously, and to reduce my fertilizer inputs. And by smothering it, by putting that there, you know, I'm kind of reducing my herbicide. There's a lot of bennies for having it there. But, yeah, I am working them into plots. I like to put them on the edge of plots in particular so I can blow the leaves over on them. And if I'm mowing, like, I don't know, say I got a bush hog and I got one to hit all the raspberries in that thick edge and knock down last year's growth and get it to jump back up every few years or whatever. Well, all that stuff that hits the ground is woody refuse that it can eat. And let's say that I'm trying to get a 3-point attachment wood chipper for my tractor, you know. Well, if I got brush coming down and I want to, free mushroom food. You know,
yeah.
I can shoot it right there on the edge, and then I know it's going to, and I'm doing it usually on the downhill edge, of course, but I also have them in little islands, and then I plant in them hazelnuts in some. I've got American chestnuts and white oaks and apple trees and, you know, things like that in them as well, because I want to improve the growth rate, and it does.
Yeah, Matt, one question I want to bring up just as a counterpoint. And this has not come up with me specifically, but I was asked this question recently. And this was a client question to ask me because I was bringing up the mushroom plot scenario to him as an option. And he said, well, what about slugs? I see slugs all over the place. Is that something we need to worry about?
Yeah, I mean, mushrooms and slugs go together, but what else goes with slugs? Snakes, and, you know, salamanders and toads. And it's, you know, nature provides a solution for every problem. If you put a food resource out that attracts more slugs and you give it the right conditions and the time, it's going to adjust. right? I had a huge slug problem whenever I put the new logs or the new mushroom farm at the new site, right? I put all those mushroom logs there. I mean, we're talking, you know, thousands of mushroom logs, right? And so, of course, there's going to be slugs all over them. It's a mushroom-rich area. Well, as soon as I put that in there and I increased it to that capacity, wouldn't you know it, little snakes and toads and salamanders and tree frogs and everything you can imagine descended upon them. And by the middle of the year, I had almost no issues. But if I had jumped on my, you know, my high horse and started riding, I would have been going in there putting sluggo in there, which messes with the amphibians and throwing the whole thing out of whack instead of just letting it take care of itself. That's a lot of what organic gardening and farming is about, you got to give it some time to take care of itself. You don't want to create a cycle of dependency. You want interdependency. Right. I don't want to be out there messing around with everything. I want to be off my property. That's why I developed a sit and forget scenario for growing mushrooms, not a always messing around scenario.
And so to that point, and you just suggested having, you know, natural enemies of slugs, right? That's a good concept. One of my recommendations was for the client was, again, I liked them around vernal pools because mm-hmm. that creates the amount of kind of the frogging relationship there that I just mentioned. And so that,
slugs are the big driver for fungi. You ever see slug trails in the forest whenever it's dry?
Yeah, sure.
You ever? Okay. Well, those, if you look at those also correlate to the mycelial design or string theory, you know, yeah. our nervous system.
Yes.
Okay. Well, one further, when those slugs are crawling all over those mushrooms, eating them, they're getting covered in spores. Now they're crawling off and they're gluing those spores down on everything they touch. And so slugs have co-evolved with fungi forever. It's just part of it. You're going to get bugs with them too. Yeah. Yes, they are edible to humans, but you got to get them for the bugs and the slugs too. And the deer do, you know, and if you want some for yourself, grow some up by your house, you know, or by your camp. But yeah, the bugs that are inside those mushrooms that have a life cycle inside the stems or the stipes, well, the deer come through, they eat the tops, they leave the stem and the stipe. If the turkeys and other, you know, grouse and everything else that come through don't pick those apart for the bugs in them, you know, or just eat the mushroom stems themselves, which I see quite often. The mice will probably carry away chunks of them, things like that. So there's a whole soil food web that's going on there. You know, the bugs are being predated by other bugs, and those are being predated by salamanders. And, you know, each thing kind of has its place in there, and we pull anyone out and it puts the whole thing in peril.
Sure. That makes sense. Yeah. It's the balancing equation. We're getting towards the end of this, and I know we probably got a bunch more to talk about. We'll probably not get to it on this podcast, but I've got a little bit of a different scenario. How do we spice things up? And what I mean by that is if we have one of these mushroom plots that are productive, you know, is it the type of species that we use for the mulch, or is it additives that we can provide to even create more interest? You know, what are the things that we can do to make things even better? Have you gone down that road and say, well, if I use this species, like in my area, sugar maple, versus I'm using a poplar, for example, does sure. that create different textures or tastes for the particular animal?
Softer hardwoods, and which are lighter lignins, and they're easier to decompose. So they're going to be more productive.
Okay.
Faster, but those denser hardwoods are going to be slower to yield up front, but longer on the back end. So it kind of goes both ways. Sugar maple produces, I've always used sugar maple for shiitake logs instead of oak. Everyone tells you to do oak, but oak has a strong flavor. Sugar maple has a nice mild flavor, and if you grow them side by side together, you're going to see that the sugar maple has a more pleasant aroma and flavor to it, right? And so I do believe there is some of that, but I've made them out of everything from red maple and popple and aspen to oak, and I mean, you name it, pine mixed in, cedar mixed in, all kinds of stuff over the years. I've never seen them have a taste difference. Now, the yield differences might occur. And if you want to jack up the yields or make it more frequent, number one way is irrigation, brother. Water is life. And the more water that you put in that area, the more mushrooms you're going to get.
Okay.
It's that easy. And live water, what I mean by that is a bacterial-rich water from a live resource like a pond, right, is better for fungi.
Absolutely.
I don't know if you've ever heard about this, but when people brew beer, some people go look for nasty, scummy pond water because it adds something that they can't put their nose on that makes that beer incredible. Right. And it doesn't give it a nasty, scummy flavor, but there's a bacterial complement in there that somehow some way makes it way better. So live farmers using a litany of farming practices. I know the people that grow magic mushrooms, live water with a bacterial element is kind of essential to that process for whatever it's worth. So live water is going to be better than groundwater for that. And any water is better than no water. All that being said, more mass helps too. You know, the thicker you make it, the more it can hold water, the more productive it's going to be over a longer time. And then I am experimenting with all kinds of additives. I don't have anything that I can say definitively right now helps it, but there is a lot of research that suggests that certain bacterial colonies, like bacillus in particular, would help. So I'm looking at everything from Korean natural farming inputs like raw milk sprays, which are about bacillus, to more bag-ready or sprayable options. I have 30-something plots planned this year, almost 40 of them, that are just small 5x10s, bait, what we call a starter plot. And from that, we're going to apply multiple different products and see, measure any yield differences. Now, historically, if you threw like a triple 19 on there or something, it would actually decrease the fungal yields because it has to spend time breaking down all those salts.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's a great example.
But it wouldn't eliminate it, you know. Yeah. And then if you're going to spray Gly on it, it's really not going to mess with it. Mushrooms are nature's grand molecular disassemblers. They break everything down to individual molecules and then reassemble them however they want. So they break all the carbon bonds, basically, right?
Yeah.
And so it's no longer H2O or, they can do whatever they want to. They can break uranium down and then they disperse it across the landscape so it's no longer toxic.
Yeah, they're toxic removers. Yep.
Yep. The solution to pollution is dilution in their case.
Well, good. All right. We've gone about an hour here, and I know there's a lot more to talk about, and we'll probably have to have a follow-up podcast, which is great. A ton of information, and you're extremely interesting. What's the best way to get a hold of your product, to get a hold of you and your product?
myco-habitat.com or mushroomplots.com or mushroomfoodplots.com. My wife bought them all for whatever reason. You can just find me on Facebook, Myco Habitat, M-Y-C-O, the word habitat. You can reach out to John Teeter and he'll put you in touch with me. You can check the description of this podcast and probably find a link. I'm around and my phone number is listed if you got questions. I don't charge by the minute or anything like that. Give me a call. Let's see what we can do. I want to do some innovative stuff with new and interesting people, and I'm always up for a challenge.
Yeah, and it's a pleasure talking to you and knowing you. And there will be more from us probably in the future. This is a great conversation. At least gets people thinking differently and then make that step. It's an easy, it's a cheap option. It's an easy opportunity for you to get to connected with a new concept and idea. And it's important that we evolve, that we think differently. And that was the intention of this particular discussion. So Matt, I appreciate your time, your insight and your support. And I look forward to continue to use your products here with myself and my clients going forward. So thank you.
I appreciate you, John, and I appreciate you letting me sporulate all the minds of the listeners in your Johnosphere. And I look forward to talking to you, basically later today, probably tomorrow, the day after. You know how it goes.
All right, brother. We'll talk again soon.
Take care.
See ya.
Bye.
Maximize Your Hunt is a production of Whitetail Landscapes. For more information on how John Teeter and his team of experts can help you maximize your hunt, check out whitetaillandscapes.com.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.